Really, what I'm trying to say is we're going to move on. We're going to get Brexit done. We're not going to be shackled anymore to the great behemoth that is the European Union. We're not going to be like Spurus, who was the castrati, who was castrated by the Emperor Nero and made into his wife. We're not going to be anything like Spurus anymore. We're not going to have the Emperor Nero taking off our the Emperor Nero being the European Union, of course, taking off our manhood and making us into his lady piece. No. We're going to leave the European Union. We're going to get Brexit done, and we are going to get our testicles back and sew them back on using whatever equipment might be at hand. I'm not really sure what that would be, and sew them back onto our penises, and we are going to get Brexit done, and we're going to move on from there. Britain has a great future. I assure you, it has a great future outside of the European Union. Unlike Sporus, with its testicles intact, a manly nation once again, and it's going to be a great time. It's going to be an absolute great time. And hello, and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. And what I'd like to talk about today is people like Boris Johnson. And that is to say, English eccentrics. Now, a number of you get in touch with me with interesting ideas, and I'd like to thank the person that suggested this idea. It was a French person that suggested it, actually. And the idea was, why is it that English people are so tolerant of eccentrics? Why is this the case? He argued that someone like Boris Johnson wouldn't be in with a hope of hell of being elected as a prime minister in France or being elected as president of France, let alone with a massive landslide. So what is it about the English? What is it about the English that makes them open to these eccentrics? And as a stereotype, by the way, it does appear to be true. There was a very interesting study by a Cambridge academic by the name of Miranda Gill. And she argued that as early as the 18th century, it was remarked upon by French writers and writers in other European countries that the English were eccentric, that the English were open to eccentrics, that the English were happy to give eccentrics power and influence that the French and other European countries simply wouldn't tolerate, and that the English were a permissive of people who were eccentric and unusual and allowed them to kind of flourish and provided a sort of atmosphere in which they could go as far as they could in a way where they would be kind of suppressed and criticised as weird deviants in somewhere like France. Now, this is not something that's been quantitatively proven, that the English are more eccentric and more interested in the eccentrics than the French, but there's a great deal of sort of literary evidence that stereotypically that would be the case, and as I've discussed before, research by Lee Jussim has indicated that stereotypes do tend to have a considerable degree of truth. So it probably is true that the English are more eccentric and that the English do encourage and are attracted to eccentrics in a way that other countries are not. So what's going on? Well, what is eccentricity? Well, normally we define eccentricity as a person who is basically unconventional and a bit strange. In general, it has relatively positive connotations. If you say someone's mad, weird, or whatever, or strange, then that has negative connotations. You're saying, I want to keep away from them. They're a bit odd. But if someone is eccentric, it's as though it's mad or unusual or deviant or whatever, but in a kind of good way, in a kind of way that's just about within the borders of social propriety, and which may also be useful to the society, which may also be beneficial in some ways, like an artist or a mad scientist. Scientist or someone of that kind. So the eccentric is this ambiguous term in that way. It's kind of saying the person's a bit unusual. He's not quite part of the in-group, but he's also not quite part of the out-group. He's in some kind of border zone between the two. So it's a very interesting idea. Now, to the extent that psychology has attempted to measure eccentricity, the main attempt at this has been done, and I'll put a link to the paper below, in what's called the eccentric perceptions scale. And what this does is it gets aspects of behaviour and also ways of seeing the world which would generally be regarded as by most people as eccentric, and so you factor down these different possibilities into these clusters that come together of different things, ways of seeing the world, which would be regarded as eccentric by raters. And that's how you develop a broad understanding of what something means and what is eccentric. Now, a lot of these are aspects of the personality trait openness. As we've discussed before, personality, psychologists talk about the big five personality traits. These are conscientiousness, which is rule following, agreeableness, which is altruism and empathy, extroversion, which is feeling positive, feeling strongly, neuroticism, which is feeling negative, feeling strongly, and openness, which is a kind of peculiar
mishmash of different things, which refers to kind of aestheticism and being a bit artistic and being a bit open to new ideas and having quite liberal views and things like this. And this all kind of comes together under the rubric of openness. And some psychologists have criticised the usefulness of it. But anyway, the eccentricity scale correlates with a lot of aspects of openness, such as unusual beliefs, impulsive behaviour, being emotional, being very, very enthusiastic and whatever. And the very interesting thing that they found was that the eccentric perception scale correlates with two key personality disorders. That is to say, people that are sufficiently unusual, if you like, sufficiently deviant, sufficiently peculiar, that it becomes of interest to psychiatrists. This is schizotypal personality and borderline personality disorder. This is what eccentricity, of all the different personality psychiatric conditions and whatever that it could possibly relate to, is the most strongly related to, these two things. Now, what is schizotypal personality disorder? Schizotypal personality disorder is marked out by social anxiety, by often quite disordered thoughts that seem to be all over the place and whatever. Now, often, of course, a highly intelligent person that has this can distill these disordered thoughts into something quite interesting and original. Paranoid ideation, so the belief that you're being harassed and people are trying to get you to varying degrees of extremity. Seeing the world in a very unusual kind of way. Seeing the world is somehow unreal, as almost like a solipsist might see it. It's almost that it's not really real, that it's all in your head. Extremely unconventional beliefs and also occasions of psychosis. Psychosis can involve absolutely false paranoid beliefs about the world, but also it can involve things like intense religious experiences. Now, schizotypal personality is on a sort of scale where you have normal, then you have schizoid, which has aspects of schizotypal personality, and then you have full-on schizophrenia, which is a full-on disorder where you would require psychiatric treatment, and this has other things to it as well, like anhedonia, where you don't experience joy and this sort of thing. So a person who is schizotypal is going to come across as quite a cold, distant person who is social, very antisocial, who has really bizarre kind of peculiar views, and often perhaps you might expect them to be quite religious as well, because they will be paranoid, and therefore they'll be paranoid about the world itself. They'll see a mind everywhere, including behind the world itself. Now, an example of someone like that would probably be Sir Isaac Newton. Sir Isaac Newton rather fits with that, and other analyses have argued that he was schizoid, or possibly schizotypal. The second personality disorder, as I said, that it correlates with is borderline personality disorder. This is a very different personality disorder. This is kind of, in some ways, relates to neuroticism, and it's much more common among, schizophrenia is also more common among females. These are both more common among females. And it involves intense emotions, very intense and strong emotions, emotions that are felt so strongly and intensely that it takes a very long time to come down, whether it's a positive or negative emotion. Very strong emotions are hard to come down to the normal baseline, and often a very distorted sense of self. So you don't really understand who you are, and therefore you experiment with different identities, and you create this persona which is kind of not really you, which is an attempt to deal with the fact that you're insecure about yourself and you feel negative feelings very strongly and you're kind of not sure who you are. And you can sometimes become, as a consequence of this, very detached from reality in how you see yourself and how you see everything else as well. Now, these kinds of people have often suffered childhood trauma of various kinds and so on. I looked at a different video at borderline personality in itself. But that's another thing that correlates to eccentricity. But it only correlates with it. It's not the same thing as the eccentric perception scale. It simply correlates with it. So what you would expect is that the eccentric, the person who is regarded as eccentric by society, to have aspects of the schizotypal personality or to have aspects of the borderline personality, to be, in a sense, a unique cluster of things in itself. Now, the only detailed attempt to kind of pin down, really, what the eccentric is was published, it's called Eccentric! Published by Dr. David Weeks of Royal Edinburgh Infirmary in 1955. And he basically took the view that eccentric eccentricity kind of falls between psychology and psychiatry, and it hadn't really been looked at in much depth. And he took the view that often, because eccentricity in England anyway has, or Britain, has positive connotations, it's not an insult. And so often, if people say, people will tell, if they think a person's eccentric, they will tell them. People who are eccentric will be aware that they're eccentric because they're sufficiently sociable that they'll have kind of friends and things that will openly tell them that you're eccentric. And so they'll realise that they're eccentric. They'll understand that they're eccentric. In a sense, they'll have to kind of create a sense of satisfactory identity based on this common belief that everyone tell, or a lot of people tell them, that they are eccentric. Now, what he did was he went to various pubs and other places that people might go to, and he simply put a card saying, eccentric, question mark, if so, contact David Weeks, Royal Edinburgh Infirmary. And there was quite a substantial uptake of people that did this. And what was found was that there were a number of factors about all these people that got in touch with him. One was that they, when he interviewed them, they didn't in any way respond to looks of confusion or boredom on his face. So they were so enthusiastic about whatever subject they were talking about, because they often have special interests as well, which is perhaps an aspect of autism which would be associated with eccentricity, that they couldn't understand why anyone would be bored. They just yatter and yatter and yatter. Secondly, they were extremely self-obsessed. They were even more self-obsessed than the average schizophrenic. So remember that these different personality disorders are components of different things. They're kind of like a shopping list. So it's quite possible if you come under schizotypal to actually have aspects that are schizophrenic and aspects that are merely schizoid, and they come together into categorising you as schizotypal. So that's quite interesting. So they were actually more self-obsessed than schizophrenics. They were outgoing, they were reasonably outgoing, sort of friendly kind of people, but they did not need company. They were in that sense, they were introverted. It was not necessary for them to have company. They were very secure in themselves. In that sense, they were unlike a person that has borderline personality disorder. They tended to be first born. Observation. They tend to be bad at spelling, he noticed. I don't know quite why that would be. They tend to have a sense of humour, a very childlike, wicked, kind of mischievous sense of humour. Now, that would make them unlike a person that was schizotypal, because being a schizotypal is often associated with anhedonia, with not feeling joy, and therefore with not having much of a sense of humour, a bit like Sir Isaac Newton. But they weren't like that at all. They had a great sense of humour. They were quite happy people as well. They were quite happy in themselves, which makes them unlike people that have schizotypal, certainly, and perhaps also some people that have borderline personality, that they can kind of present a persona of being happy. They tended to have very high IQ. They tended to be overwhelmingly male, which is interesting, because of course both of these conditions, schizophrenia and borderline personality, are predominantly female conditions rather than male conditions. It's autism which is very much more the male condition. And they tended at school tended to be a problem for them because they were disordered kind of people. They didn't like order and rules and things like that. And so they didn't like school, and they particularly didn't like sport. So what are these eccentrics then? What are they? Well, they seem to be a very specific constellation of things. You can't simply reduce them to schizotypal personality, though it correlates with aspects of it. You can't simply reduce them to a borderline personality disorder, though it correlates with aspects of it. It's its own separate thing, eccentricity. They are outgoing, nonconformist, slightly childlike people that in many ways have traits that don't easily even fit into the big five. So what is going on? What are these people? What's a reasonable theory for what they are and why England would proportionately have lots of them? Well, I would argue it relates to genius. So, as I've discussed before, there are various strategies by which a social group can win in the battle of group selection. You pass on your genes directly by having children, and you pass on your genes indirectly by investing in your kin, and you pass them on indirectly further still by investing in your extended genotype, in your ethnic group. And this creates a situation where there is a battle for group selection between different groups, and the group that is the most adapted to the ecology and the most able to win that battle will, of course, do so and will triumph, and it's that group and that group's genes and whatever that will be passed on. Now, various studies have found again and again and again that it is the there are different ways of doing this, of winning the battle. The main way is through being highly ethnocentric, positively and negatively ethnocentric. A good example of this can be seen in the Japanese. They are adapted to a very cold and harsh ecology. What this selects in favour of is people who are highly internally cooperative and high in agreeableness and whatever, and high in rule following, and therefore highly internally cooperative, highly positively ethnocentric, but they also are highly negatively ethnocentric. They will treat the outsiders severely and destroy them and whatever, and as was seen in the Second World War in the River Kwai or whatever. And that is the group that will tend to dominate. Now, they have to have that way of doing things because they have a small gene pool, and in an ecology of that kind, to have people who were deviant, to have people who were a bit different, to have people who were a bit eccentric, would be very difficult, because the flip side of having, if you, as it were, geniuses, would be people who were antisocial dreamers or whatever. So that is why you don't get many geniuses in Japan and in China compared to in Europe, in terms of per capita major innovations or whatever. Because what the genius is basically, it has been found again and again and again in studies of genius, is a person who combines outlier high IQ with moderately low agreeableness and moderately low conscientiousness. And what this means is that they have outlier high IQ, so they're intelligent enough to be able to conceive of the breakthrough. They are a breakthrough will always offend against vested interests, but if they're low in agreeableness, they either don't care about that, they're not very nice people, or they're so kind of autistic and low in empathy that they couldn't conceive it would cause offence even if they did care. And they're low in conscientiousness, they're low in rule following, and this means they can think outside the box. Now, that is the essence of the genius. Now, those traits, in terms of individuals and in terms of groups, they tend to go together. It tends to be high conscientiousness and high agreeableness that tends to go together with intelligence. So it's very rare that you're going to get someone that has high intelligence and moderately low agreeableness and moderately low conscientiousness. So the way you will get people like that is if you have a reasonably large gene pool such that people like that can be thrown up just by genetic chance. This is less likely to happen in an ecology such as Japan because they are evolved such a harsh and stable ecology, and the selection pressures are so strong that consequently anything that's a bit different is selected out, and so you don't get much happening by genetic chance. So you don't get many geniuses. Also, they tend to have outlier high IQ. In somewhere like Japan, you don't get many outliers because that's a function of a large gene pool. You don't get many outliers. And also, as I said, the flip side of these geniuses, these people that are going to be positive for the group because they're going to come up with these amazing inventions and things like this, which are going to do good for the group in warfare or whatever it is the flip side is going to be the antisocial dreamer or the psychopath or the criminal or whatever. And that can't be tolerated in a society that's under such harsh and difficult conditions. And so they don't produce many geniuses per capita. As you move towards Europe, you get a larger gene pool. And therefore, the possibility of genius, the possibility of a different strategy is awakened. And that is what I call the genius strategy. And this is that if a group has relatively low ethnocentrism, certainly relatively low negative ethnocentrism, then what that means is it can trade with other groups and it can learn knowledge from them and it can expand. And with its geniuses, it can also beat them in warfare because the geniuses will come up with amazing inventions that will benefit the group. And therefore it can expand further and the gene pool can expand further and it can throw up yet more geniuses that come up with yet more brilliant inventions and it can expand further and further and further. And consequently, the Europeans, even though they are not as intelligent on average as the Northeast Asians, and they are lower, according to research I've done, they are definitely lower in positive and negative ethnocentrism, they have fared considerably better than them in terms of the contributions to civilization, of genius, of inventions, of art, of whatever it is of any importance, because they produce far more per capita geniuses. The Japanese are more group selected. But the Europeans are group selected in a different way, whereby they have low ethnocentrism, but this genius tradition, and these geniuses come up with inventions which allow them to overwhelm their people, to overwhelm the entire world. So the geniuses can be and to have a massive gene pool. If you think of the size of the British gene pool, it's not just Britain, it's America and Australia and Ireland and all these other kinds of places. So this is where I think they come from. As for the British, well, what can be suggested is that the British are perhaps, for whatever historical and evolutionary reasons, they are this genius culture par excellence, which is consistent with evidence that the British hugely expanded throughout the 18th century and 17th and 18th century. It was the British that expanded into America. And my colleague Michael Woodley of Manee and his colleagues have shown in the new book, which they've done on this subject, they've shown the way that there was a point where the French population was larger than that of the English. And then the English population becomes larger than that of the French. And then it eclipses it, and what this is showing is that the English are winning the battle of group selection against the French, and they're winning the battle of group selection against the French, it seems, because they are producing more, for whatever reason, just geographical good luck or whatever, they are producing more per capita geniuses. And because they are producing more per capita geniuses, these geniuses are coming up with brilliant inventions, and this is allowing Britain to rule the waves and expand and expand and expand. And so under these conditions of group selection, of Darwinian selection, of course, it would follow that you would want to, the people would have to be tolerant of these geniuses, these antisocial types. And if the people were tolerant of them and nurtured them and kind of helped them, then they would be more able to come up with their brilliant inventions and further allow the group to win the battle of group selection and come to kind of dominate the world with a massive empire based on their amazing inventions, industrialization, and all these kinds of things. All of these innovations were at the hands of these kinds of genius types, these high IQ, moderately antisocial people. And so, and this is what Gill comments on, that the French were in complete disbelief as far as the French were concerned at that time. You had individualism versus deviance. Individualism was related to deviance, rather. And what you needed was communalism and everyone getting on. And that's very much what France was like. And they were very much kind of rather more hostile to difference. And then there was this kind of movement away from that in France as they saw what was happening in Britain, of being more valuing of poetic-type people and artistic-type people and all this kind of thing. But the British were more valuing of these kinds of people at an earlier stage, reflecting perhaps evolution, but also reflecting the fact that they would... That because they were more tolerant of them, they were more able to flourish. So this is what seems to have happened in the history of Britain, and this would explain why Britain has these very high per capita levels of genius. Now you can see how the eccentric and the concept of the eccentric crosses over with that of the genius. So you could argue that the eccentric is the flip, is on his way to being a genius. He has aspects of being a genius. He is unconventional. He has a childlike sense of humour. He has high IQ. He's into unusual things and doesn't follow the rules. He's obsessed with things. He's very self-obsessed, and a lot of these geniuses are very self-obsessed and just driven by their own desires. He doesn't need company and can just work on something that fascinates him for ages and ages and ages. It is in many ways that the eccentric can be seen as a sort of watered down, diluted version of the genius. And you would therefore obviously expect a society that produced lots of per capita geniuses to produce more eccentrics. These being these kind of semi-geniuses or people that had aspects of genius. And you'd expect that society that had that genius strategy, that's how it won the battle of group selection, to be more tolerant and interested in these genius types than would other societies who had employed a more ethnocentric, communalist, cooperative strategy, where we're talking about high positive and negative ethnocentrism, the individualist type person. That's what geniuses are. They're quite individualist, although what they do helps the group without them perhaps meaning to. But it helps the group. It's a group level thing. That's what they are. They're a group level phenomena. But they are individualist. They're unusual. They're deviant. They're strange. And so you would expect the British, therefore, in comparison to other countries, to be literally more evolved, to be more tolerant of these genius types, and thus more evolved to be more tolerant of these eccentric types, because the tolerance of the genius type has allowed them to flourish as a people and to win the battle of group selection against France and other competing countries, and therefore it would follow that they would have to be more tolerant of the eccentric type and more liking of them and more open to deviance and more open to people being unusual and being a bit strange, because in under Darwinian conditions it was those kinds of people that made amazing breakthroughs which allowed the society to dominate in the battle of group selection. And so the society, in order to have dominated in that way, would have to have been more tolerant of people like that, where a less tolerant society would have destroyed them, or killed them, burned them, driven them out. And that brings me back to Boris Johnson. So why are what kind of person is Boris Johnson? Well, Boris Johnson does seem to have all of the aspects of eccentricity that we noted earlier. He is a person that has unusual interests and goes on and on about them, such as Greek philosophy and Latin and whatever and things like this. He's clearly self-obsessed and talks about himself a lot and has this sort of this sense of who he is and his own mission. I don't know whether he is a person that needs company or could just get on his own, but it seems possible that he would get on his own. Is he first born? I'm not sure about that. He certainly has a childlike and sort of sense of humour. He comes across as a very happy kind of person. He probably has reasonably high IQ. He's male, which fits with it, and he perhaps has aspects of borderline personality as well, such as apparently he was always Alex Johnson when he was a boy, and then he decided as he got older to adopt this persona of Boris Johnson and to change his name to Boris Johnson and to become Boris Johnson. So there could be a degree to which, as with borderline personality, he is kind of created to deal with the negative feelings or whatever. He has created a self, and therefore there could be a degree to which he has detachment from reality and these kinds of aspects of borderline personality. So that, I think, is why we English are more tolerant of eccentrics, to the extent of having a person who is manifestly an eccentric as our prime minister. We have adopted this genius. This genius form of selection, of group selection, as against an ethnocentric form of group selection. And this has meant that we are highly open to genius types, and eccentrics are simply those that have aspects of genius, and this would make us more open to them. Okay, well, I hope this has been of interest, and if it has, then please do feel free to help me out by subscribing to me on Subscribestar, on PayPal, and on Patreon, and by purchasing the old books, which you will find on Amazon, and do get in touch if you have any new ideas. It was one of my followers who had this idea, and it was a jolly interesting idea too, and I've enjoyed researching it, and I will see you soon, and goodbye, chaps, and it's... Get Brexit done, yeah.